Good evening, everyone. We're finishing up John chapter 4 tonight. John chapter 4. We talked for the past two classes, but I think we're justified in it, about the account of Jesus meeting the woman at the well of Samaria. There's just a lot in that story. And so I'm grateful to you all for letting me take the time to kind of expand on that a little bit. The only problem with expanding on it is it leaves less time for everything else. So we're going to move fairly quickly tonight and try to get all the way through chapter 5. I emphasize the word try. But picking up in the end of John 4 here, Jesus and his disciples, verse 43, Jesus and his disciples continue on to Galilee after 2 days in Samaria. And we have this kind of curious statement by Jesus in verse 44. Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. But then, right after that, verse 45, when they entered Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him because they had seen everything he did in Jerusalem during the festival, for they also had gone to the festival. Now, Jesus makes similar statements to this statement that a prophet has no honor in his own country. We see it in Matthew 13. We see it in Mark 6 and Luke 4. And it's kind of a curious addition by John, considering the next verse, when they entered Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. So how do these go together? A prophet's not welcomed in his own country, but the Galileans welcome him. Well, possible explanations. Either John's drawing a contrast between the Samaritans' immediate belief. You remember the reaction of the Samaritans as Jesus speaks to them and as the Samaritan woman calls them to come to Jesus. John may be drawing a contrast between the Samaritans' immediate belief based on what Jesus said to them and the Galileans' belief, which is based on what Jesus did, what they saw. It says that they had seen all the things in Jerusalem. So these folks had been down to Jerusalem while Jesus was there for the Passover, and they had seen many of the things that he did. Or John is specifically talking about Nazareth as being Jesus' own country. And that's in connection with the other synoptic accounts. Those all focus on Jesus being rejected by his own people in Nazareth. And really, in those accounts, his own family rejects him as the Savior. In contrast to the rest of Galilee, where we see Jesus having some success. Whatever it is, the action picks back up in Cana here in verse 46. Which, if you recall, was the site of the first sign, the water to wine, and also Capernaum. Even though Jesus would have had to pass by Nazareth on his way back to these other towns, we're coming up to the account of healing the official's son here at the end of chapter 4, and it says that Jesus comes to Cana. If we recall, Cana is about 5 miles outside of Nazareth. And then he's approached by this official from Capernaum. Capernaum is about 20 miles away from Cana, on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. So the official has to come to Jesus over a great distance. 20 miles to us in a car, unless you're driving down Nicholasville Road, is nothing. However, for this official to travel 20 miles and apparently at speed to get to Jesus is no small feat for him to get there. And he's definitely in a hurry. But again, as you can see, Cana's down here just north of Nazareth, and then Capernaum is right up here on the northwest shore of Galilee. And so I don't want to glance over this story, but we do need to talk about it fairly quickly. And I have four main takeaways from this. So let's read through it, and then we'll talk about kind of some main ideas here. So John 4:46. Then he went again to Cana of Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. There was a certain royal official whose son was ill at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea into Galilee, he went to him and pleaded with him to come down and heal his son, for he was about to die. Jesus told him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe." "Sir," the official said to him, "come down before my boy dies." "Go," Jesus told him, "your son will live." The man believed what Jesus said to him and departed. While he was still going down, his slaves met him, saying that his boy was alive. He asked them at what time he got better. "Yesterday, at 7 a.m, the fever left him," they answered. The father realized this was the very hour at which Jesus had told him, "Your son will live." Then he himself believed, along with his whole household. This, therefore, was the second sign Jesus performed after he came from Judea to Galilee. So again, in our list of seven signs, this is the second one, and it's the one that John specifically mentions is the second one. From this point forward, we won't have John numbering these signs, but he specifically mentions this. And so then we have this official that comes to Jesus. It's possible that this official may have been an official in Herod's royal court. So right there, we see kind of some potential friction. We already know that the Herods are no friend of Jesus and his family. And we'll see what happens with John the Baptist and everything as a result of their meddling. Many people confuse this account with the account of the centurion servant in Matthew 8 and Luke 7. Now, I just want to be clear. These are not the same accounts. They have very similar things within them to each other, but these are not the same account. But as far as some takeaways here, first of all, the official humbled himself because of his need. Again, this is someone who has very high standing, and he comes to Jesus. As we mentioned, Cain is about 20 miles away from Capernaum, so he did what it took to request an audience with Jesus. I like what this commenter had to say. There could be no more improbable scene in the world than an important court official hastening 20 miles to beg a favor from a village carpenter. This guy knew what Jesus had done in Judea. So just like the people in Galilee had heard, this official had heard. He knew what Jesus had done. And so he comes to him desperate. Desperate. We don't know if his faith is all the way where it needs to be yet, but the fact that he's made this journey means that he's taken the first step. So that's a big thing. So he humbles himself to come to Jesus, as the commenter says, a poor carpenter who is gaining some fame as a rabbi. And then he begs Jesus. And certainly after these events take place, word of this official's actions would have gotten around. But he doesn't appear to care about the consequences. He's not interested in people's gossip. He's only interested in his son. His need is greater than his pride. I think we might take some takeaways from that, shouldn't we? That if we're coming to Jesus, our need has to be greater than our pride, and we've got to put one below the other. So the second takeaway then, he refuses to be discouraged. Despite an apparent rebuffing by Jesus initially, the official persists in his request. And, you know, when I read that, I kind of think of the persistent widow, right, from Luke 18, that she asked the court official, and then she asked the court official again, and he says, "Well, lest this woman keep coming to me, I'm going to give her her request." I don't think Jesus was put out by this man's request by any means. But it does show that he's willing to do what it takes. And so then Jesus' statement there in verse 48, he's either talking to the crowds in Galilee who have only believed in him because of the signs that they saw in Jerusalem, and says, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Or he's talking to the official and saying, "Unless you see a sign and a wonder, you're not going to fully believe." And so he may be testing then the official's resolve. Would the official act petulantly? Would he retreat in despair because Jesus isn't giving him what he wants at the time that he wants it? Or would he continue to believe that Jesus was the only answer for his son's illness? So, he's at a crossroads, just like many of the other folks that we've seen. And I think that we see the result of that story. And that brings us kind of to the third takeaway. The official had faith and believed. This guy has no tangible proof or other assurance than Jesus' words that his son is going to get better. Yet, when Jesus says, "Your son will live," he doesn't say another word, at least as far as John records for us. He turns right back around toward home, apparently satisfied with the answer that he's given. That takes a lot of faith. I mean, this guy cares enough about his son that he comes 20 miles to Jesus. And Jesus just says, "Your son will live," and that's enough. That's it. He takes Jesus at his word. And really, if you look at the text, it's the next day before he even receives word of his son's recovery. So he turns around, goes home, probably has to stay somewhere overnight because he can't make the full journey home. And it's not until the morning that somebody comes to him and says, "Your son is alive." Can you imagine what that night would have been like? To have no proof, no word, nothing. All you know that your son is at the point of death. And yet, he's satisfied. And so then the result of this story then, and this is the most important part, and this is the part that John wants us to get across. This official buys in. He fully believes now. So when he gets word, he doesn't simply get his wish and then forget the one who gave it. You know, he's not ungrateful, and he's not with Jesus when he gets word, but he's not ungrateful for it. And it says, he himself believed along with his whole household. At the mention of the time of his son's recovery, he knows it's not mere coincidence that his son gets better, because he knows exactly when Jesus told him it was going to happen. And so we see again this kind of pattern. This man has an initial experience with Jesus. He comes to find out more, and all this is a very brief experience. It results in faith, and he helps his family believe. He tells his family, and they consequently come to belief as well. So we're still seeing this pattern in John. The only thing is that this is kind of where this pattern is going to come to an end, per se. We will still see people believe in Jesus, but on this scale, we're not going to see this for a little while yet, because we're about to come to a time of controversy. Anything else on John chapter 4, this particular story? Okay, John 5 then. We have the next sign in our list, the healing of the man at the pool of Bethsaida. Let's just read through this, and we'll make some application here. So verses 1 through 9 to start with. After this, a Jewish festival took place, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. By the sheep gate in Jerusalem, there is a pool called Bethesda in Hebrew, which has five colonnades. Within these lay a multitude of the sick, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water, because an angel would go down into the pool from time to time and stir up the water. Then the first one who got in after the water was stirred up recovered from whatever ailment he had. One man was there who had been sick for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the sick man answered, "I don't have a man to put me into the pool when the water's stirred up. But while I'm coming, someone goes down ahead of me." "Get up," Jesus told him. "Pick up your bedroll and walk." Instantly, the man got well, picked up his bedroll, and started to walk. Now that day was the Sabbath. Okay, So, Jesus then comes to Jerusalem. Now, it says he came to Jerusalem for a Jewish festival, or one of the Jewish festivals. If we understand this festival to be another Passover, then that means it would be nearly a year after the events of chapter 4. So some time has passed. If you remember, we talked about this a little bit. John is much less interested in chronology, in linear chronology, than he is in getting a point across. And his point is belief. That's his whole thing. And then if you're kind of curious about where it says up to Jerusalem, the fact that Jesus is in Galilee, he has to go south to get to Jerusalem. So why does it say up to Jerusalem? Because it's on a mountain, right? So he has to ascend to go up to Jerusalem. So just kind of a point of clarification there. But then he says, by the sheep gate in Jerusalem, there's a pool. So just kind of getting a sense of the city. If you got Jerusalem kind of in your mind's eye, you've got the temple complex. Just north of that temple complex is a pool, which is this pool called Bethesda or Bethsaida. And then just north of that is what's known as the Sheep Gate. If you recall from Nehemiah's time when they're rebuilding the walls and they have the various gates throughout the city, the Sheep Gate is the first one that is rebuilt in the wall. And this kind of, it might kind of make sense. This is not where they're grazing sheep, taking them out of the city. It's where they're bringing sheep in to sacrifice them at the temple. So the name makes a little bit more sense when you think about it that way. then again, we have this pool, this Bethesda. There's variations on the name. There may be Bethesda, Bethsaida. There's, I can't remember what the third one is. If it is Bethesda, it does kind of fit the theme because Bethesda means house of mercy. Again, it's kind of understandable. But here around this pool lays a multitude of the sick. Now, how many people are reading from the NIV or the ESV? All right. Is there a noticeable gap there between verses 3 and about halfway through 5? Yes. Okay. So I may have read something in mine that you don't have in yours. And that is the part about the angel coming down and stirring up the water. I would like to tell you I have some sort of definite clarification on this. I don't. I don't know if this really is an angel. It's kind of a curious way of going about things where the first one gets healed and the next one's out of luck. I don't know. It could also be just a superstition. The belief is that an angel comes down and stirs up the water. Certainly, there are a lot of religions that have water as their focus. Spirits are in the water, and they do certain things. And if there's moving water versus stale water, and all those kinds of things, honestly, I don't know. Some even speculate that this was written in later, after John had already written this account, that it's added in by the scribes as kind of an explanation of why all these people are around the pool. I don't know. But nonetheless, a multitude, it says, is gathered here. Now, that could be anywhere from 50 to 500 people, this multitude. I'm also curious that maybe if this is a rumor, and this is just kind of spitballing here, if this is a rumor, I wonder if it's kind of propagated by some of the temple officials or folks in Jerusalem to kind of localize all these sick people and keep them in one part of the city. I don't know if that's the case, but it's a thought. But nonetheless, kind of get this scene in your mind's eye. Consider the human element of this. If you've ever been to a place or another country where there are people gathered, even just a few people that have some sort of debilitating or long-term illness, it's a pitiful sight. there obviously people have tried to depict this scene in paintings or drawings, and they kind of have this man in his robes on the ground, and you know, he may look kind of poor, but he's dressed just kind of like everybody else. Typically, someone that's like this, from what I have experienced, these people are dirty. They are broken. They are, I hate to put it this way, they're filthy in terms of hygiene. They are not something that we like to, that's pleasing to the eye. Don't ever go Google third world illnesses because you won't like what you see. And so again, consider the human element of this. This is what Jesus is seeing, suffering all around him. And these people trying to essentially race to this pool when it's stirred up. These people are desperate and they're unable to take care of themselves. That's the bottom line. And so then we have this one individual then. One man was there who had been sick for 38 years. That's a long time to have a long-term illness. The details of this story, we can see that this man is paralyzed at least from the waist down, if not more. And we aren't provided with the specific reason why Jesus chose this particular man. It may be that he was well known due to his long-term illness. It may be that Jesus saw him on one of his prior trips to Jerusalem and recognized him when he came back. Don't know. But it's certainly evident, especially from his response to Jesus, that he's given up hope. He just can't get to the pool, so he's just going to sit here in his misery with all the other miserable people. He is hopeless. And so Jesus comes up to him and asks this kind of interesting question: do you want to get well? And I don't think this man thinks that he can get well. But nonetheless, he gives the description to Jesus. But then Jesus, all he says is, get up, take up your mat and walk. That's it. Jesus challenges that hopelessness by giving this man a task. If you ever want to break somebody out of a cycle of depression and despondency and hopelessness, give them a job to do. And this man has one simple job, and that's to get up and take his bed and walk. And so Jesus gives that to him. Now, pay attention to the fact, this healing doesn't come as the result of this man pleading to Jesus. He doesn't beg Jesus to heal him. For all intents and purposes, he doesn't even know who Jesus is. He's going to be asked later, who's the man that healed you? And he said, I don't know who he is. But Jesus senses in him a desire for healing, and he supplies the need. There's a need, Jesus meets it. This is really the main two pillars of this story. And then the result is going to be belief. So then the result of this then, immediately the man is made well. And there's all kinds of translations on that. There's made well, made whole, there's healed, all these things. I think the words made well is probably the best translation. Look at how many times throughout the account, and kind of keep going down through there, how many times John uses the phrase made well. It's like four or five times here just within this couple of paragraphs. So I think John is using that term very specifically. Healed, certainly that's what happens, but it doesn't quite express the full importance of what's happening here. Notice, again, how many times the phrase made well. That the word made there in made well is genomai. It's the same word that John uses to describe Jesus' active role in creation in John 1. Jesus is using the same power that he used to create the world to remake this man's body. And the thing is that the word that John uses there is immediately. Immediately. This is not some process. This is not some partial healing. Immediately, this man is in one from one state to the other. by Jesus' will. Jesus' will is the only thing that makes this happen. So John continues there. He gives us further details. That day was the Sabbath. This is now the turning point where John's gospel moves from honest consideration of Jesus by the people to controversy and conflict caused by the religious leaders of the day. So this is now where the paradigm shifts as far as people's attitudes towards Jesus. And so the Jews then see this man carrying his mat, and they say, "This is the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to carry your mat." Verse 10. Surely the Jews had seen this man lying outside the pool, yet their first statement to him is not to wonder at his renewed condition. 38 years this man has not been able to walk. He's likely an old man at this... Sorry, an older man at this point. He has been in this state for a long time, and people probably know that. And yet their first reaction to him is not wonderment. How did this thing happen? It's, you need to set your mat down, because this is illegal. Just missing it completely. But the thing is, though, is that they mention this law. It's not lawful for you to carry your mat. Can somebody find for me the Old Testament passage where it says that you can't carry your mat on the Sabbath day? Okay, I didn't think so. I didn't know if you had a side reference there in your Bible or something. No, it's not there. Now, there is in the Jewish law the Mishnah. And the Mishnah has to deal with festival days and customs and the Sabbath and rules around the Sabbath and those types of things. The Mishnah lists 39 things that a man can't do on the Sabbath. And then they have secondary explanations for all of those things. The 39th thing is that a man cannot carry a burden from one place to another. And the basis for that is in the Old Testament. We see it in Jeremiah, we see it in Nehemiah, where work is being done. But the idea in the Old Testament of that work being done is for commerce. These are merchants carrying these loads from one place to another. Or in the case back in, I can't remember if it's Leviticus or Numbers, where the man is caught picking up sticks, and then he has to be stoned as a result of that for doing work on the Sabbath. This man is not performing work. This is not work in as much as it's the command of Jesus. And so then his answer to the Jews: "The man who made me well told me, 'Pick up your bedroll and walk.'" Now, this small transgression, again, like the man picking up sticks, is potentially punishable by stoning. This guy's got to give some explanation. He can't have gotten back full use of his legs and then be killed immediately afterwards. He's got to give an explanation. So the man feels the need to tell them. And the implication of the man's explanation, I think, is similar to Nicodemus' original sentiment in chapter 3, verse 2, where, remember, Nicodemus tells Jesus, "We know that you've come from God, because no man can perform these signs unless God sent him." And that's got to be the guy's mindset. This guy just healed me after a 38-year illness, most of which I wasn't able to walk for. I figure if he's telling me to walk with my mat, I should do it. If for nothing else, then as a show of gratitude. He's got to be acting and speaking in accordance with God's will. So the Jews apparently go away, and then Jesus finds this man again in the temple complex. And one thing, I don't have this in my notes, but one thing I find interesting about this man was lying outside the temple complex at this pool because he was paralyzed. He was diseased, if we want to put it that way. He was unclean, according to the old law. Where is he now that Jesus finds him? He's in the temple. He's allowed to come into the temple. If you remember, under the old law, someone who had a defect, a birth defect, or had some sort of physical defect was not allowed to come into the temple. This man's defect has been removed. So he can now fellowship inside the temple. He's able to associate with God's people and worship inside the temple. And that's where Jesus finds him. And so then Jesus speaks to him. See, you are well. Do not sin anymore so that something worse doesn't happen to you. So to this point, the man's illness was the worst thing that has happened to him in his life. It's ravaged his body. It's ruined his life. He can't do anything as a result. So then Jesus takes this disease, the example of this disease, and as he has with all the other folks he's talking to, he's taken something that's everyday and commonplace, and he's going to make a much larger spiritual point out of it. And he uses this disease as a picture of something much worse in the man's life, and that's sin. Sin would have had much worse consequences than physical deterioration if it had not been dealt with. Jesus says, I have healed your body. You are physically made whole. Now you need to go take steps to spiritually be made whole. Now, obviously this man can only go one side on that. Jesus is going to be the thing that makes him completely spiritually whole. But Jesus says, this is a two-part process, and you need to go take care of some other things. And so then we see the Jews' reaction. That they come to Jesus, they've gotten this explanation from the man, and it says they began persecuting Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. This is not the only time in the Gospels that we see the Jews persecuting Jesus for healing on the Sabbath. Mark 2, Mark 3, Luke 13 and 14, these things happen. And specifically in Luke's account, Jesus reminds his critics that a man was allowed to rescue his neighbor's animal on the Sabbath, if you recall from the old law, and rescuing a man would be of far more importance. So this is not an argument that's unfamiliar to Jesus. He's had this before. But here, in this particular instance, Jesus' argument for healing is that God's activity doesn't cease on the Sabbath. He says to them, my Father is still working, and I am working also. This statement is going to be the linchpin for the whole rest of the discourse that's about to follow. And I want to get to that, so we're gonna jump into that. I saw this quote. Jesus teaches that human need must always be helped, that there's no greater task than to relieve someone's pain and distress, and that the Christian's compassion must be like God's, unceasing. Other work may be laid aside, but never the work of compassion. And so Jesus is getting ready to tell them, and he's telling them here, my Father's working, so I'm working. You remember way back when Jesus was a boy and his parents found him and asked him, what are you doing here? What was his response to them? Did you not know that I needed to be about my Father's business, my Father's work? So Jesus has known from a very young age that he needs to be about God's business. And that's what he's telling them. Do you not know that I need to be about my Father's business? Sabbath day or not, this is my Father's business. So let's go to verse 19 here and read through. This is the discourse that results from this. And again, this idea of my Father is doing something, so I'm doing something. This is the main idea. Jesus replies, I assure you, the Son is not able to do anything on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son also does these things in the same way. For the Father loves the Son and shows him everything he's doing, and he will show him greater works than these that you will be amazed. And just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so the Son also gives life to anyone he wants to. The Father, in fact, judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, so that all people will honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Anyone who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Okay, so a couple of main ideas happening here. First of all, throughout John's Gospel, Sorry. I'm going to try to keep up with those. Throughout John's gospel, Jesus continually states that his work is to do the will of his Father. And so here, Jesus makes four points concerning his relationship with God and how he's going to carry out God's will. First, he acts just as the Father acts, verse 19, in the same way as the Father. Verse 20, on the basis of love, the Father reveals all his works to the Son. Verse 21, the Son, like the Father, has power over life and death. And then the fourth point, verse 23, the Son has been given authority to judge by the Father. Now, in all these statements, first of all, Jesus is certainly saying the Father's work and my work are one. But the undertone of all this, and it's the one that's infuriating the Jews at this very moment, is the fact that Jesus is equating himself with God. He's placing himself on a level with the Father. And he is essentially, although not directly, but essentially declaring himself to be the Messiah. He calls himself the Son of Man, which, if you recall, that's a reference back to Daniel chapter 7, among other places. The Son of Man is going to come in with authority and rule the nations. Secondly, he talks about having power to raise the dead and give them life. You might go back to Ezekiel, the vision of the dry bones. And remember, God asked Ezekiel, do you believe I have the power to give these bones life? Jesus is saying, I have that same power. The power that Elijah and Elisha exhibited, I've got it. And we'll certainly see that in a very physical sense later on. But all of these are summed up in a single purpose here at the end of this. So all people will honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Or if we want to put it in the terms that John has used and will use throughout the rest of the gospel, all people will believe the Son just as they believe the Father. If you believe in God, and you believe in all that He's said and all that He's done, you believe in Me. And that's the point of this discourse, the whole thing. We're not going to have time to get through the whole thing now, but we'll try to reach a stopping point. So, Jesus says, verse 24 then, I assure you, anyone who hears My word and believes in Him who sent Me has eternal life. And these two ideas are inextricably linked. The one who believes the Son expresses belief in the Father. The one who does not believe in the Son clearly expresses their disbelief in the Father. And so then the one who does believe is going to be granted life by the Son. The Son is the one granting life. And so verse 25 through 30, Jesus has just given this example of being able to raise the dead. And He says, I assure you, an hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who have heard will live, or those who hear will live. And this has meanings on the physical and the spiritual level. So just looking at what Jesus says here, He says, verse 26, for just as the Father has life in Himself, so also He has granted to the Son to have life in Himself. Jesus is not just the means by which these people are renewed to a new life. He is the source of that new life. The life comes from Him. And John told us that in John 1 through 18. He is the source. All things are created through Him. And so then the extension of that is, verse 27, He has granted Him the right to pass judgment because He is the Son of Man. And again, that's a reference back to the Son of Man having authority over all nations. And Jesus says, I can do nothing on my own. I judge only as I hear, and My judgment is righteous. Who gave Jesus the judgment, the ability to judge? God did. Is God's judgment righteous? Is He going to give it to anyone who is unrighteous? No, He's not. Jesus is righteous, and so His judgment is righteous. As such, His judgment is always correct. it's always fair, and it's always indisputable. Jesus is the law. He is the judge. And because it's righteous, it is always right. His judgments are never wrong. And we've got these two images. We've already said that Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, but he also references himself as the Son of God here. Now, some folks believe that he's putting these two images together to kind of culminate here, because as the Son of God, he knows the will of God, and he can execute justice righteously and purely. But as the Son of Man, living among man, he knows the trials and the struggles of man, and he can sympathize with man in judgment. And aren't those two things that we want? Don't we want, first of all, a judge who is fair? If you're being taken to trial, if you're being sued, or you have a case in court, don't you want a fair judge? Of course you do. Especially if you're in the right, or if you believe you're in the right. You want a fair judge because he's going to be impartial. He's not taking one side over the other. And so Jesus, as the Son of God, as God's representative, is ultimately fair. But Jesus came to live among us. And just like when he went and he saw this man lying at the well, he sympathizes with this man. Jesus has suffered. Jesus has known want and hunger and pain. And he can sympathize with this man knowing that he's in pain. He is in want. He's in need. And so then, when it comes to judgment, when it comes to him being an advocate, he has experienced everything that we have. He has been tempted in all things as we are, to use the New Testament. Okay, so we're going to pick up in verse 31 and talk about these four witnesses then that Jesus calls in to testify on his behalf. But again, the linchpin there is the Son and the Father are one, both in purpose, in will, and in essence. So keep those in mind, excuse me, as you're looking at 31 through 46, and then we'll pick up in chapter 6 next time. Thank you.